Thank you. Well, it's now time to move to the third part of our evening, in which we're going to move on to a continuation question. The first question was, what degree of history and theology are reflected in the New Testament accounts of Jesus' resurrection? The second question is, what is the theological or historical significance of this? And I'm going to ask Dr. Habermaster to take a microphone.
Okay, so I'm answering the theological and historical significance of these things. Because I do a lot of work on historicity and on that timeline and topics like that, sometimes I'll be out at universities or something and somebody will say, excuse me, let me mark this. I don't want to go too long. Thank you. And somebody will think that Habermas is all about evidence, and if it's not evidence, he's not interested. Far from it. I think the New Testament teaching of resurrection, in fact, I'll just give you some stats if you're interested. The resurrection teaching is found in over 300 verses in the New Testament. It's linked to almost every area of theology, and it's linked to almost every area, well, many areas of practice. So I take this to mean that when New Testament writers over and over again say, as Paul does, citing another early creed, by the way, Romans 1, 3, and 4, where Paul says Jesus is shown to be the Son of God, Lord, and Messiah by his resurrection from the dead, Paul is arguing from resurrection to Christology. When in 1 Peter 1, 3 and following, the author says, it's because of the resurrection that heaven has been secured for us, can't be taken away from us, we can rest in this hope that the resurrection gives. In passages like that, and there are others in the New Testament, it seems that the hope of theology and then practice is centered on the resurrection of Jesus. And I would be very much one to say that we do our historical homework before we do some of our theological and ministry homework, but we must get there. We must get to both of those. Now, I will give you a personal illustration here. In 1995, my wife died of stomach cancer. And I'm remarried, but in fact, I say this with my wife around, teasingly. It's not right that a man should have two great wives. But I'm remarried, and I've been blessed very much with a second marriage. But still, my family had to go through my wife dying. Four children home, the youngest one 9 years old. Inoperable cancer, you know the story, opened her up, sewed her back, we can't do a thing, and she passed away in 4 months. Prior to her sickness, I had done some writing on pain and suffering, and I had been doing some application. What would resurrection hope mean for death and dying? A topic that Paul addresses in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. He addresses again in 1 Thessalonians. And Paul has this statement that I think is very meaningful. He says, we mourn, but not as those without hope. And I mused upon that. Well, I mean, my wife was sleeping 18 hours a day, and I had a child monitor up in her room, and I would go out and sit on the porch, and I would, as it were, imagine myself asking God these questions. Why is my wife suffering? You know, she's only 43 years old, and we have four children, and she's got a husband who doesn't know the difference between hot and cold and colors and whites. And funny thing, my kids need a lunch every morning when they get up, and they need a breakfast, and they need a lunch, and then someone's got to be here for dinner. And just, I was overwhelmed, not to mention having to take the tubes. She had stomach cancer, having to take the tubes out that they inserted and give her 4 rounds of medicine a day and 3 rounds of food and clean these tubes, and I was just exhausted. And I was trying to think about the truth of resurrection. And what got my attention most in Paul's treatment, two things. In 2 Corinthians 4, he said our mind should not be on our suffering. And he gives a little bit of account of his own suffering. He says, talks in terms that today we might even talk about his depression. But he says, we despair, but we don't lose hope. And he said, all this is because the resurrection secures heaven. And then he goes on for those first memorable, very difficult 10 verses in 2 Corinthians 5. And then later in Philippians 1, he says, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. 2 verses later, he said, I prefer to die and be with Christ. And then the verse I referred to where he says, okay, thank you. And where Paul says, we mourn, but not as those without hope. So I think where resurrection has significant pastoral application would be in counseling, for example, or in comforting, and in the difference between mourning with hope and mourning without hope. I think what resurrection says is that believers have hope, and that seeing a loved one again. I mean, the most meaningful card I received during this time was from someone who said, think about that day when you'll be able to walk again hand in hand with your wife and see her. And I have to tell you, I was so moved, I couldn't recount the words of the card for the next 6 months. To me, that the resurrection boils down, it's not all about evidence, it boils down to very pastoral and practical consequences.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I find that very moving. And I'm not sure what I'm going to find to ask you about that. I guess I'll worry about that in a few minutes. So what is the theological significance of the answer to the first question about the relationship between the New Testament accounts and history? I guess my own point of view is that the narratives about, let's take the resurrection appearances, and also the different gospel accounts of the empty tomb, they are not, to quote the title of an evangelical bestseller, doesn't seem to me that they are evidence that demands a verdict. I think it's a mistake to try to prove the resurrection. It can't be proven. It can't be disproven. It's a matter of faith. And I hope it won't be thought provocative if I quote Rudolf Bultmann here, who in his commentary on John, he's explicating what John is saying about the enemies of Jesus in that gospel. And he says, they conceive the divine as a phenomenon whose divineness a person can verify by means of his own criteria, rather than the divine being an occurrence which destroys the person who tries to verify. That is, that Jesus' enemies in John's gospel, who don't think that Jesus conforms to the criteria that have been laid down in Scripture, are trying to verify whether or not revelation is happening. And Bultmann says that he thinks that is a mistake, and on that I agree with him. I don't agree with him about everything. But it seems to me that those, and I don't know if Gary Habermas is one of them, but those who try to prove the reality of the resurrection, for example, by trying to show the unassailable historicity of the empty tomb narrative, are doing the same thing that Jesus' enemies are doing in the Gospel of John. They're trying to subordinate the explosive power of God to a human criterion of validation. It seems to me that rather than being evidence that demands a verdict, the empty tomb narrative and the gospel accounts of Jesus' resurrection are a puzzle and a challenge and a mystery. And the way in which one responds to that challenge doesn't so much depend on reasoned argument or proof, but on whether or not, like the disciples at the end of the gospel narratives, one believes that one has encountered the risen Christ. So the fulcrum of faith is the resurrection of Jesus, and belief in that resurrection is based on whether or not one has experienced it. One has experienced living Christ. But now for me, this poses another problem, and I briefly discussed this problem with my Intro to New Testament class. That is, are the resurrection appearances of Jesus unique? And here I'm drawing on my friend Dale Allison's book, Resurrecting Jesus, in one part of which he compares the New Testament accounts of Jesus' resurrection with accounts of the appearance of departed people to the bereaved. You know, it happens across cultures and across centuries that people report and maybe some of you here have had experiences like this, that people who've had a loved one who has recently died sometimes report that the loved one appears to them. And there are some striking similarities, I think, between these reports and what the New Testament describes. The departed person may suddenly appear and appears to be as real as anybody. And then he may or she may suddenly disappear. And there's a whole series of similarities I could talk about, but I'm being given the finger by Jimmy Wells. That's an American expression. But I guess what I want to say is I don't know what to make of these similarities. I guess one difference is if the person who has recently lost somebody goes to the grave, then probably the bones of the person are still there. And maybe that does point to a reason why the empty tomb narrative is important, because it attests that something more explosive is claimed to have happened in Jesus' appearance after he has died. That something is claimed to have happened that changes the world and that gives hope, where there wasn't hope before for everybody. But it seems to me that that is the really difficult thing to believe. You know, that the world really has been decisively changed by this resurrection from the dead. And I think that's, when confronted the difficulty of that assertion, is where we have to say with the father of the epileptic boy, I believe, help my unbelief. It seems to me that that is where faith always stands.
The fourth part of our evening, and the fifth part will be you. So, getting ready. But the fourth, that's better. Yeah, that's good. The fourth part is the second chance to interact with questions. So it starts with Dr. Marcus asking the questions.
I don't have a lot to ask about, you know, your last discussion. As I say, you know, I find it very moving, and I guess the only thing that I don't see is what your answer to the second question has to do with the first question. Because in the second question, I mean, you started it off by saying that belief in the resurrection doesn't have to do with evidence. But it seems to me that your answer to the first question was all about evidence. So I guess, I mean, maybe we both see a disjunction between each other's historical work and their theological work. But I don't see what the relation is between your, what I take to be, you know, an apologetic approach to the historical evidence, which it seems to me is trying to establish that the resurrection appearances are historical. And what you were saying in the second part, in this hermeneutical part, so help me with the connection there.
Sure, thank you, I'd be glad to. I take a different stance than you do on this, and I think that if the that how we answer the first question determines where you come down on the second question. Now, just to answer your other point there, the question you just made, I don't think the resurrection can be proved in the sense that I don't think any inductive statement deriving from, say, history can be proved in any sense like that. I do think we can give reasons and say it's more likely than not, or that it's probable. I think we can make that move. But I don't think I would want to say, well, you know, I'm really glad that I'm going to see my wife someday because this is linked in the resurrection. But by the way, I don't have very many good reasons for the resurrection. I would be very worried about my response, just speaking for myself. I would be very worried about my response if I didn't have any reason to believe there was another life. And by the way, those people who, the ones at Dale Allison, the long list of, that's a very well-known phenomenon. I have a book at home that gives 2,000 of these cases. I've also, second only to the resurrection, has been 25 years of work on your death experience. It's a very similar category. I would just ask, what if those people really have seen them? What if a near-death experiencer really does repeat something from the real world? So again, I'd say there it's a question of evidence too. In fact, Dale Allison gives an evidential case, a very interesting one regarding his father. But anyway, to answer your other question, I would say that meaning is based on facticity. Now, and I think, I would be bold enough to say, I think that's where the New Testament's going. By the way, you mentioned Rudolf Bultmann saying we're kind of held hostage by this kind of thing. I remember Rudolf Bultmann's treatment of 1 Corinthians 15, and he's arguing with Karl Barth. And Barth's very bothered and says we shouldn't be given evidence for the resurrection. And Bultmann says, well, look, I agree with you. We shouldn't be given evidence for the resurrection, but let's concede. Paul thought he was given evidence for the resurrection. So I think I would try to take that stance and say I would argue more from what I perceive to be the New Testament hope. They would think that if Jesus has been raised from the dead, we shouldn't be guessing about what follows from it if we don't have some sense that could be true. But I'm not talking about apodictic certainty or science or something like that. My turn. Okay. Since we kind of pursued the line from our first question to our second question, let me do the same thing. You're talking about explosive power in the early church that's derived from the disciples encountering the risen Christ, and that we can encounter the risen Christ today, I assume you'd want to say. Let me ask your question in reverse. What good does it do to say this is anchored in faith if faith at this point, what is it faith doing for us? Seems to me that if we're going to try to believe something so incredible as resurrection and we don't want it to be evidenced much, how does that comfort faith? It almost sounds like guess so to me instead of hope so or faith that.
Well, I guess I don't think, first of all, that you can try to believe in this. Belief is something that's either given to you or not. And, that all the wishing in the world Jesus rose from the dead isn't going to make it so, and isn't going to make you believe that it's so if you don't believe it. And I guess, in my own experience, it wasn't something that I was seeking, but something that found me out. So I guess, everybody's kind of egotistic and interprets the world on the basis of his or her own experience. I don't want to be heard to be saying that everything is dependent on faith in the sense that people have to manufacture a belief in something that they don't believe. I think faith is a way of seeing. It's a way of seeing something that one can't prove. When you're talking about this sort of category of revelation, you're talking about something that comes to you from the outside and that cannot be established by the use of reason, I have one who is, she's a youth of unreason, but she's a mixture like all of us. What else? And I guess I also think that faith is not illogical, but I also don't think that it can be proven by logic.
Yeah, just for the record, I don't think it can be proven by logic. And to me, there's a difference between reason and history. Those are different categories. If I could push a little bit, though, how, in what sense, what good is it to hope for something that we're not sure if it's there? Now, I know you reckon we're not going to close all those corners on this one, and I admit that. But if we don't have some direction from data, why would we launch out in faith, especially on something so touchy as losing a loved one? Why would we want to build that on a I hope so without any grounding, any data? I mean, I respect your view. I have a lot of colleagues who sometimes argue the same way, and I ask them the exact same questions. I don't understand why we would want to build faith on faith or faith on hope so that's not grounded.
Well, I don't think that's what I'm saying. I don't think I'm saying that you base your belief on just saying, I hope this is true. I don't know if it's true. I mean, I think it's true. You know, it's convinced me, you know, what I've been through. But I hesitate to call it data. I mean, it seems to me that in using that term, you are entering into a realm of logical and historical contestation where I don't think faith properly belongs. You know, faith belongs in the category of testimony to what one has seen, but it's not a matter of data and proof.
Well, thank you. We've spent, just to go back over the last hour, we've had Dr. Habermas gave us a very helpful account of how his scholarship is done, particularly in relation to other scholars, and in terms of finding common, relatively uncontroversial ground and building apologetics from there. And Dr. Marcus identified particularly the soldier at the tomb, Matthew's Gospels, as a way of focusing the issues of whether one identifies a particular historical detail as crucial in the sequence of events. And we've ended up very much focusing in the last 10, 15 minutes or so on the nature of faith and reason and historical evidence. That's been a pretty thorough treatment of a number of the issues. I don't think any of us here would say that's a treatment of all of the issues. And my sense is that in the room there will be connections that have been made here that won't be obvious to everybody. There will be questions that have always bothered you, or recently bothered you in the incisive courses you've been doing here or elsewhere, that haven't been addressed. So I'm going to ask you to speak to the person next to you about what those are for a couple of minutes, so that you can dazzle them that you find the confidence to dazzle us.
We get some more water.
I'll say this on behalf of the Senate. I would not for a second attack the Florida leader to say, only have faith in my health. I've been down that door. And how to me, this isn't a left, right, or center thing. It's a difference in persons and religions. I would say, the person said to me, hey, I don't need that. I'd say, it's a good thing. I don't want to tell anybody what else Christians say.
Thank you.
This is as loud as I can talk. And it turned out to be loud enough. I'm going to take two or three questions at a time, and we'll see if we can stay in a broadly similar theme, and if we don't, then the sheer skill of our respondents will see us through. Do you want to start us off?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Dr. Marcus, Dr. Haberman, very nice to see you. I was curious about the hallucinations, like when you were actually referring to the one person, or I don't know how many people you were talking about with the hallucinations, saying that that's the possible parallel to what the disciples saw. But 1 Corinthians does say that there were over 500 people that saw Jesus at once, and I don't know if any of the hallucinations that you're referring to included more than one person.
They do sometimes.
So we've got an opening question about hallucinations and whether those could apply to up to 500 people.
I have one
people.
More too, but I'm
looking. I'm sure we may have time for that, but not now.
It's more convincing if there's 500. Yeah.
Okay. Can we go further around the room? Hands up, please. Furthest back. Thank you.
I have a question about the disciples. Them seeing the resurrection appearance of Jesus and actually whether they actually saw it or whether it was a hallucination, does that have an effect on whether or not they have faith or not?
Okay, relationship between whether they really saw Jesus or thought they saw Jesus.
Does that have, like, them with the evidence, the data, the physical relationship of actually receiving Jesus, does that discount them of having faith in the resurrection or...
Okay, thank you. Yeah, well, we can work with that. Thank you. And
I was wondering if you would, Dr. Marcus, wondering if you would preach on something you find historically doubtful or dubious in the Gospels.
Would you preach on something you find historically dubious in the Gospels? That's one just for Dr. Marcus. Who would like to start off? I think you brought up the hallucinations, didn't you? So do you want to go
ahead? Yeah, right. Well, I hope I'm not hallucinating now, but...
You're appearing to more than one time.
That's good, yeah. That's his line, but I'm appearing to more than 200 people at one time. Well, most of you are still here, but I do see one leaving right now. So. And I think I know why. Short answer to that... in Dale Ellison's book, he does mention, and there's a footnote, you know, to some of the primary evidence that sometimes people do report that there has been an appearance of the departed one to more than one person at once. But I didn't go into, I didn't look at the evidence and find out how many it was. And I mean, certainly you have things like appearances of Mary. To a lot of people at once in various places. So I don't think that it's out of the question. So, yeah.
Do you want to, while you're here, talk about whether you preach something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I preach on things that I have historical doubts about all the time. or that I'm not sure that they happen in exactly the way that they're described in the Gospels. And I don't think that... And I usually don't talk about whether or not it's historical. I enter into the story, and I see what the story is saying. And sometimes I preach with the story, and sometimes I preach against the story. Yeah, because it seems to me that the great thing about the Bible is that it's alive, and it's something that you can interact with. I don't know, for example, what to make of the accounts of demon exorcism in the Gospels, which are ubiquitous, especially in the Gospel that I've devoted 20 years to writing on. It seems to me that what is described in those cases looks an awful lot like what we would identify as, in some cases, schizophrenia. In one case, epilepsy, and in other cases, other mental disturbances. But the Gospels, and probably Jesus himself, thought about it and think about it as demon exorcism. Now, I also think that, you know, those exorcism stories say something very powerful and true about where we stand and just the bondage in which we find ourselves to forces that we can't control. But I, you know, if you, you know, ask me, do you believe in demons or not? Well, I don't know how to answer that question. I don't think it's condescending, however, to preach on things that one has historical doubts about. I don't think that that's the place to explore these historical questions. You know, that the place to explore that is in a classroom setting, which can be in a church as well as in an institution of learning.
I've already, the last question I know was for Dr. Marcus, but I'll just say briefly, I've already given my view. I think preaching could be done in a lot of contexts, a lot of bases, on stories or not, but if I'm going to base something on something that I want to be substantially true, I'm going to, like resurrection, I want to do the historical homework. On the faith and resurrection question, I'm not sure the direction, but let me take a stab. I don't think having evidence for something any more rules out faith than thinking I'm marrying the right person or saying that I'm saying I do to the right person rules out problems in marriage. I think I can make decisions based on where I think things are, and I think that's what wise people do. But that doesn't rule out the fact that we're working together and faith and a lot of things work here. But again, based on what I've experienced. Last one about hallucinations is really the first question. Let me take some odds with Dr. Marcus on this one. I've been working with the clinical psychologist. We've been doing this for a long time, and I'll just say there are no records in any of the clinical data of group hallucinations. Now, I think the question is, just because there's groups, take Gail Allison's account of his dad being seen afterwards by some of the grandkids, I think one really good question there is this both meant to be an hallucination? I don't think he's saying that in the text. I don't think he's suggesting that. I think he's saying, boy, what do I do with this? On the Marian apparitions, 10,000 people go to Medjugorje, and a lot of people claim to see things. But they're not claiming to see Mary. They're claiming to see sometimes data. I mean, they're saying things like the sun spinning or the stars, and that's an illusion. That's not an hallucination. The difference is, an illusion is when you see something and interpret it as something else. An hallucination is a much more radical concept. You say something for which there's no external referent and say that such and such is here. Here's my deceased wife standing next to me. And you folks think you have to call Dr. Wenger back there from the Duke Medical School and have him do some psychiatric evaluation of me. But I don't think there's anything in the literature. I don't think we've found any cases of group hallucinations. So I think scholarship rightly asked the question, if there are group appearances, if there are group appearances of Jesus, that's very hard on the hallucination thesis.
I think the word hallucination is a loaded term, which I didn't use, because it seems to me that what it implies is exactly what you just said, you know, that one's seeing something that isn't there. And that's precisely the question. Right? Is one seeing something that is there or that isn't there? I don't know how in taking up stories like this about the appearance of the dead, how to answer that question in a historically reliable way.